Hey there, my lovelies. Welcome to the 56th episode of Final Girls Horrorcast, the show where we discuss some of the horror, thriller, and sci-fi movies currently available on your favorite streaming sites. I'm Amy.
And I'm Carly.
This week is a very special episode. Not only is it the final installment of our Halloween marathon month, and my goodness, it felt like a marathon, didn't it, Carly?
Holy cow, this is the longest month of all time, and I freaking love October. I'm like looking forward to November. It's not even Halloween yet.
But we're going out with a bang, right? We're going to be discussing today the very popular UK Halloween special Ghostwatch, but we're also going to be lucky enough to be joined also by Ghostwatch writer Stephen Volk a little bit later on here in the show. So please stay tuned for that exciting interview. We're actually doing an interview. We're almost like a real podcast now, Carly.
Almost. We're so close.
We're so close. No, we're super lucky and happy to have Stephen Volk on. So please stay tuned for that. Ghostwatch is currently streaming on Shudder, but I feel like there's no real spoiling it at this point. It's one of those things where I feel like the more you know about it going in, the more fun it is to watch. So if you haven't seen it, please feel free to stick to the rest of the episode. It's not going to negatively alter your experience at this point in time, I don't think.
I agree. I don't think that there's really, like, spoiling to this.
Yeah. I'm going to exclude the spoiler warning this episode. But before we jump into Ghostwatch as a whole, let's get started with a segment that we like to call
Trailer Trash Talk.
Today's trailer is Winchester, The House That Ghosts Built, with a theatrical release date of February 2nd. It's directed by the Sperrig brothers, Michael and Peter, who both directed Jigsaw, so we spoke about them recently. It's also written by the Sperrig brothers and Tom Vaughn. The IMDb summary is, eccentric firearm heiress believes she is haunted by the souls of people killed by the Winchester repeating rifle. I am familiar with the Winchester house. Carly, are you familiar?
I've been wanting to go to the Winchester house since I was, like, little. Like, I saw this shit on the Travel Channel when I was a tiny human. And it's all I've been wanting to do. Leif and I have been talking about going, like, planning a trip to go up to San Francisco and going to the Winchester house. Like, I've wanted to do this for a while.
I would absolutely love to go to the Winchester house. I think going to the Winchester house would be much more exciting and thrilling experience than watching this movie, in my opinion, after seeing this trailer.
I don't know. Yeah, I get it. I'm stoked about Helen Mirren being in this.
I'm surprised that Helen Mirren isn't.
Me too. I didn't realize until I was listening actually to the Modern Horrors podcast.
Doesn't she have anything better to do than be in this movie that looks terrible?
Yeah, she does.
It looks not good. I'm sorry.
It just looks weird.
It looked cheesy.
Okay, I can see that.
The ghosts look silly.
It reminds me of, like, Ghost Ship.
Yeah.
Obviously not like the way that the movie plays out, but the way that the movie looked, it reminded me of Ghost Ship.
It has, like, a cheesy look to it, and I don't understand why they're doing this. Are they trying to make it easily accessible for all types of viewers by making these ghosts look like, come on. I'm not into it.
It just looks weird. Part of it reminds me of, like, the, again, with a ship, like the Queen Mary's, like, Haunted Maze commercials where, like, the bellhop is, like, comes in out of the corner. Like, things just things look really weird and forced and unnatural.
Yeah. It looks like here's some formulated scares that are tired and you've seen a million times and put them in a commercial or a trailer. This, like, no, it's not enough. It's just not enough. It's not enough. It doesn't look scary. I was laughing when I watched the trailer. I was like, is this for real?
I saw you respond to it and start laughing.
I was laughing because it looks so silly. And it's sad because it's a really interesting story. And it sounds like it's kind of following the at least somewhat truth of this story. that we have the heiress to the fire, the Winchester rifle, and she believes that the house is haunted by those who were killed by the rifle. Yes, that's something I've read before. That's an honest depiction of the story. But you can't take a true story and then make it look like this. It doesn't look real at all.
I mean, it looks like a weird Unsolved Mysteries episode.
Yes. It just doesn't look like Helen Mirren is in this.
I'm honestly surprised.
Yeah. Not excited about it. Okay. Well, let's start talking about Ghostwatch. Are you ready for that?
So ready.
Cool. Are you ready enough to intro it?
Oh, yeah. I'm so used to like there being two movies that I don't really understand how to just do this one.
It says
it's
your
confusing
name
to my brain.
Next to it.
Oh my god, it's in pink, guys.
Yeah. And it's giant and bold.
Jeez Louise, my brain. Guys, it's been a rough night. I'm not ready for it. All right. Anyway, the only movie that we're talking about this week, Ghostwatch from 1992, directed by Leslie Manning and written by Stephen Volk, who also did The Awakening, which we talked about a few months ago here. Mm-hmm. The IMDb summary is the BBC gives over a whole evening to an investigation into the supernatural, quote unquote. Four respected presenters and a camera crew attempt to discover the truth behind the most haunted house in Britain. Expecting a lighthearted scare or two and probably the uncovering of a hoax, they think they are in control of the situation. They think they are safe. The viewers settle down and decide to watch for a laugh. 90 minutes later, the BBC and the country was changed, and the consequences are still felt today.
Wow, that's quite a summary.
That was quite a summary.
That's a summary of the whole event, not just the special itself.
Yeah, which is streaming on Shudder, by the way, if you haven't seen it.
Yes.
We talked about it already, but, you know,
yes.
Throwing it out there again, Shudder, because it's awesome. It's really cool that Shudder does stuff like this.
Yeah, I'm really glad that it's on Shudder. So, Carly, this was your first time watching Ghostwatch, yes?
It was.
Oh, can you share with us your first impression of the film?
So I did a little reading before watching it. And I thought it was really cool and interesting. I really like a lot of shows on the BBC, like not just current ones, but me and my friends used to like love like Garth Marenghi's Dark Place. And it had like a similar, like that's supposed to kind of take place like late 80s, early 90s, I think. Mm-hmm. So it kind of was like a similar vibe. So I kind of felt like, oh, like fell right back into it. I really enjoyed watching this. I really enjoyed my time with it. And just the whole story around it is so fun and interesting, and I wish that I wasn't like 8 years old or however old I was when this thing came out, because I feel like I would have been like super into it.
Yeah, I mean, in America, it's not like we really had access to the BBC in 1992 anyway.
Right.
But I just love, I felt the same way that I first learned about Ghostwatch listening to the Girls in the Back Row podcast. They do such a good job. That show does such a good job of really going in depth. And Tab in general,
yeah.
The host of that show, who also does Test Pattern now, is so good at doing research and providing such like rich information. She really got me interested and excited about the movie before I even was able to watch it, because it's not like this was an easy, or still is an easy thing to watch. I know there's a DVD now. Which I'm sure you can get online somehow, but it's not like you could just go into a store and buy it. And it's not really streaming anywhere unless for like some reason, some awesome reason, Shudder decided to start streaming this. And I was so excited when I saw it was streaming because I knew about it already and I knew the history of it. And I was just like, finally, I can watch this thing.
Yeah.
That has such this like mythos surrounded by it. And as Americans, we don't know a lot about Ghostwatch, but we should know a lot about Ghostwatch, because Ghostwatch has created so many movies that were so popular.
Yeah, at that time especially.
Like
years later.
maybe Blair Witch would still exist, but I can pretty much guarantee Paranormal Activity would not exist without this movie. It's really taken its hold on our genre. It really did. It definitely had an effect on the films that we have today. And it's so much fun to read about and learn about this movie. So just,
it really is. I'm really happy that we are doing this.
Yeah. I know our UK listeners are super excited, and some of our American listeners are like, what are you talking about with this Ghost Watch thing? So just to kind of give you some information on this, Ghost Watch was a special that aired in 1992 in the UK. It was a Halloween evening special that appeared streaming like it's a thing in 1992 that was a special that was airing or appeared to be airing live on Halloween night. It was marketed as a live special with different television personalities that are trusted and beloved on the BBC. Definitely recognizable faces to those who watch the BBC.
Yeah, super recognizable.
And it pretty much was like, okay, we're going to go in this house that's supposedly haunted. We're going to hear some different ghost stories, and we're going to talk to some paranormal specialists who are going to give us some information on this. That's how it was marketed, and that's how it kind of starts off. And as the special goes on and on, it gets more and more intense, and the things that are happening in this house and the stories you're hearing from the viewers. It had a live telephone number at the bottom of the screen, which was the dial-in number for the BBC. Everything about it appeared real, and a lot of people were fooled. A lot of people thought this was real. And there was a lot of media backlash because of that. There were a lot of issues because of that, and it's just really interesting to hear stories from those people. And we do have a couple stories from our listeners from the UK of their experience on their initial viewing of this special, and they remember watching it as kids. So we'll hear those a little bit later. I'm really excited to share those also. But it did something really special. It was almost like War of the Worlds. You know, people were freaking out. People thought that this was real and this was happening. So it's really, really interesting. It's really fun to watch now. And it's silly. Like, it's silly to watch now. As someone in 2017,
it's still looks fun, though.
Silly. It's fun. It's so much fun. And there's a lot of really fun things happening here. But it's still a made-for-TV special from 1992. You're not going to get a made-for-TV special from 1992 that isn't a little bit silly looking. But it doesn't mean that there's not, like, genuinely creepy things happening also. Because there definitely are some moments where I'm like, oh, I forgot that that gets a little bit creepy for a minute.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's part of the charm to it, though, as well, but also maybe, like, the effectiveness of it at the time, obviously, like, it looks super 90s, but, yes. You know, when you're watching this kind of a thing, you're, like, half paying attention almost, or maybe, like, eating dinner and watching it, and then, like, you're like, oh, like, what is this? Like, as it goes on, you're like, is this a real thing, or what's happening right now?
Yeah, and it's not like the internet was a thing then where you could just be Googling, is this real?
Or, yeah,
you know, going on IMDb to see, okay, what have these other people been in?
Are these people calling in real? Like, yeah. What? Ghosts? England? What's happening? Yeah.
So, I mean, I could totally understand how someone would fall for this, especially a child would totally fall for this. I would have totally fell for this. No doubt in my mind, I would have fallen for this. What are you laughing at?
Just the thought of it.
Oh.
I think I would totally fall for it, too.
Of course you would have. The 8-year-old Carly would have totally fallen for this.
I would have been like, what's happening?
If that was like Dan Rather reporting to you live in studio about ghosts in a house, you might take it seriously.
Barbara Walters.
Yeah, Barbara Walters reporting to you about Ghosts Walters. Live on Halloween night.
That would be so good. I just wish that that happened.
So,
come on, America.
Michael Parkinson is like the guy on the BBC. He is like the trusted guy that everyone loves on the BBC. He reports the news. He reports facts. He does interviews. He's like, he's the guy, you know? He's the guy. They call him Parky. It's the cutest name ever. I love it. I love how they found these trusted people to be actors. Now, I think he does a fantastic job. I think honestly he does a better job than some of the actual actors at acting in this movie.
Well, yeah, because he's just being himself-ish.
Yeah.
Basically. That's his job, is basically like to sit there and read the teleprompter. So he's pretty much just being himself.
Yeah, but he's I guess they ad-libbed a lot of this. So to keep it easier, I guess, and more believable, they let them kind of say it in their own voice. They didn't put it up on a teleprompter. This is what happens in this scene. Make it go. With all of the non-actors in the movie. Sarah Green and Michael Parkinson especially did not use a full script when they were acting. And I think they did an okay job. I think some of the children actors are a little less believable. There's even a couple times where you can kind of see them break a little bit when they don't think they're on camera. But it's charming and it's endearing and it's cute.
I think it's super charming.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed watching this a lot.
It's a fun little ghost story. Yeah. You know?
Especially, I think it's because, like, knowing what I, like, obviously doing some research beforehand helped me kind of more appreciate what I was watching, I think.
Yeah, I think as an American, especially going into this cold, it helps to have the background and the history because it really just makes it pop. Because if you just sit down and watch this and you don't know anything about it, you're like, why do I care?
Right.
Why am I watching this?
Right.
But really knowing the background and how there was like almost just like a freak out. People feeling duped, people feeling misled, and the media really eating it up as you are misled by the BBC, led the BBC never to show this again, and led to a lot of issues, which is crazy.
I kind of like that, though. I like that it kind of like lends to a certain, like, this is a one-time special. That's all you get. Yeah. Is it real? Is it not real? I don't fucking know. You got to figure it out. Like, not my problem.
I don't think that it's ever been shown again on the BBC. I don't know that for a fact. I don't know if, like, lately, but I know up until recently it never had. One of our listeners, Lee, hi Lee, if you're listening, said he's going to see this live in London on Halloween night.
That's so cool.
And the director and also Stephen Volk, who we'll be interviewing a little bit later in the show, will be there to answer questions. So that sounds just like so much fun. I don't think I'll make the trip out to London for it, but that just sounds like so much fun.
If I had the dollars.
Oh, my God. If I had all the dollars. In a heartbeat. Totally. I want to go to England. We have actual listeners in England. Maybe we should go there.
You guys, Can we?
I would love a break from America right now. Would you have us?
I would love to visit our UK listeners.
I would absolutely love to visit England. Okay, so it's just so much fun. There is some genuinely freaky things happening, right? We have this ghost. We have this mythos that is gradually built about this ghost in this house, which is great. Like, as the story goes forward, you start getting phone calls from different listeners and you start talking to the neighbors and you start learning more and more about this ghost named Carly. This name. What's the name of the ghost? You don't know?
I don't know what the name of the ghost is.
Mr. Pipes.
I did know that.
So,
'cause I remember laughing at it.
It's the cutest thing ever. Okay, so you might have missed this part, but it's also the best part of the whole movie is when the mother's being told by like the people coming in to check out the house that it's just the pipes. Whenever they hear banging, it's the pipes. So the mom tells the kids it's just the pipes. So then when the banging starts to happen again, the kids say, it's pipes, he's here. They named him Pipes because of the banging on the pipes. And how much as a kid do you hear your parents say, oh, that sound you just heard, don't freak out, it's the pipes. Because they said that shit a lot to me as a kid. So I think that's hilarious and super clever.
I ever heard the pipes. I definitely think I heard the wind or like, I don't know.
As someone who lived in an old house, I was always told.
That makes more sense,
it's the pipes. And I just think that that's just the cutest little clever.
It's Mr. Pipes.
Addition to it. Yes, that it's the pipes. I just loved it. I love that part so much. And we have, you know, some other really creepy things happening. We get to hear the voice of Pipes coming through a child's voice, which is reminiscent of the Enfield poltergeist, if you're familiar with that story. I know we discussed that a little bit on our Conjuring 2 episode. But there's,
I feel like a lot of this is like a lot of like the little kids situation, yeah. And even just like the settings.
There's definitely some allusions to that. And when we interview Stephen Volk, I definitely want to ask him about his history with and relationship with the Enfield poltergeist stories.
Yeah.
Because I definitely feel some of that in here with the spoons being bent and the little girl making the sounds and
them having them like her do it in front, yes, of the camera, and exactly, then trying to do it regular.
Exactly. There's just a lot of that is very much mirrored with the Enfield poltergeist. So I'm excited to hear his thoughts on that. And then there's also like the singing, the ghostly singing parts freaked me out. And even at the end, when everything just turns totally ridiculous and unbelievable, it still freaks me out at the very end. When Parky is talking and then it turns into the creepy singing, I'm not going to lie, I had a little bit of hair sticking up at the end. I had a hair sticking up moment on my arms where I was like, oh.
I just envisioned like one hair sticking up on your like head.
Just one on my head.
Just one.
Like alfalfa.
Ooh. Yeah.
No, it was more, that's like so my funny arms, you know, like the chills.
Yeah, no, I get it. But when you're, yeah, like, I had a hair sticking up. Just get this, just like.
One. Just one.
That's funny.
But it was good. I mean, some of the acting is silly, like I said. Some of it's...
It fit in with like a special, though, to me, I feel
did.
Like.
No, yeah. It did. It felt very, very 90s.
It totally.
And not like UK 90s. Like, I could see this being American, too. And there is an American on the special. He's the skeptic.
Of course.
I'm sure that wasn't by accident.
That was on purpose.
American. From York and with the Empire State Building in the background. Oh. Of his interview, which was just so silly and cute, and I loved it. The asshole American that's skeptical about everything.
Super charming.
Yeah, super charming, not.
Super charming, as it was so appropriate.
Understandable.
It was great. Yeah.
I mean, I just love it. I love how they incorporated bad things towards the end. You start to hear all these stories. Oh, all these ghostly happenings are happening at the listeners' homes. So if you're watching this, this is now affecting you. This could now be happening in your house. Are you hearing a noise? Are you seeing a thing? You know, did your lights just go out?
If I was a little kid, I would be like, oh my God, Mom, Mr. Pipes is coming.
Yes. And a lot of kids thought Mr. Pipes was coming. A lot of them did.
Mommy, Mr. Pipes is coming.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if they I'm sure they had British accents since they're in England, Carly.
Were you going to say, accurate. I'm not sure if they had British accents.
I don't know. Maybe they didn't. I don't know what I'm saying anymore.
Me either. It's fine.
But
it's been a long week.
I mean, it's a little bit silly because the woman who's supposed to be parapsychologist or whatever they refer to her as in the special, she says, we created a massive seance. It's like, how did you do that? How did you create a massive seance? By talking about ghosts?
Because they brought it into everybody's homes and their living rooms.
I mean, that definitely makes it fun and scary for people at home, but
playing along.
There was nothing that resembled a seance here in my brain from what I saw. But it's silly and it's fun at the end. I don't know. I just really I have a good time when I watch it. It's a lot of fun.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Super fun.
Yep, yep.
I was really happy that we did this.
I am too. And I'm
solid ending.
Yes, for sure.
Somewhat rough month.
Right? It was a very rough month. Okay, well, we're recording this on a different day as the interview, so let's go cut now to our interview with Stephen Volk. So here it is, Amy and Carly interviewing Mr. Stephen Volk, the writer of Ghost Watch.
Whoop whoop.
Hello, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello, Stephen.
Hi, what's the time there?
It's 7 a.m.
Oh, my gosh.
It's very
oh
early.
My gosh. But you get to stay in your pajamas.
Yes, exactly.
phone are you call in only. The same place or are you in different parts of the world?
We're in the same state, but Carly's in Los Angeles and I'm in San Diego.
Yes.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Well, that's close in American terms, yeah?
Yeah, it's not far. It's like a two-hour drive, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for joining us.
No, that's great. That's great. I've now made a massive step of joining Twitter.
Oh,
bravo!
How wonderful! So, I'm sure people will love that.
I thought I'd do it just before the 25th anniversary. You know, a couple of days before, just to see what the hell happens. But that'll be interesting.
Yeah, totally, totally.
I'm still not very good at it. It's Amy is the one.
I've kind of resisted it because I know I've got an obsessive side to my personality, and I thought it would take too much out of the day because writers are always looking for distractions, as I'm sure you know. And I thought it would just be the ideal distraction to not work all day. But I've finally taken the plunge, so we'll see what happens.
I mean, you're right about that. It is a distraction for sure, and sometimes not a great one. sometimes a very aggravating one.
Yeah, Facebook's pretty much like that too. You get embroiled in really trivial disputes, I think, over things that don't matter very much. I'm sure you know what that feels like. And then you find you've kind of wasted an hour of your life arguing over, you know, you're never going to persuade, if someone likes a film and you don't, or vice versa, you'll never persuade them to change their mind. It's a meaningless task in a way. But then again, it does keep you in contact with people that of like mind, and you can share recommendations and things. So there's a positive side of it, I think.
There certainly is. And without Twitter, we wouldn't be able to do this lovely interview with you. So
yeah, that's great. That's great. So you're supposed to ask me, but I was going to ask you. I mean, tell me when you want to start, but I was just going to ask you how you came across Ghostwatch, you two guys.
Oh, yeah, we can start right now. I'm happy with that. We can have an impromptu start. So basically, just so you have a heads up, we already discussed this film a couple days ago for this episode. So we gave our listeners kind of a heads up on what Ghostwatch is, because like I said, we have some UK listeners, but we also have a lot of American listeners who probably don't know what Ghostwatch is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we kind of give a heads up. We talked a little bit about things we really liked about it. The effect it had in the UK and that kind of a thing. So you don't have to dive that deeply into it if you don't want to. You can say basically whatever you want about it, but I didn't want you to have to go through the whole thing if you didn't want to.
Oh, that's good. That's good. We can cut to the chase. That's good.
We didn't want you to be responsible for explaining all about it.
No, that's good, because I mean, I've done it a few times, and it's hard to find a new way of telling the same story.
Right.
Anyway,
absolutely.
Yeah.
So the way I came across Ghostwatch, to answer your question, is I listened to another podcast out here. It was called The Girls in the Back Row. And one of the girls on that show is like knows almost everything about horror, just in general. Like if there's a horror movie, she knows about it. She's like an encyclopedia. And she did an episode on Ghostwatch, and I was so interested. just from the information she provided. And then it was on Shudder maybe 9 months after that. It was streaming on a service we have called Shudder, which is just
it just went on, didn't it?
So once it was on there, I saw it and I was like, oh, I can finally watch this. And and I was just so excited, and then we had to do an episode on it. So I was just so happy to do that. And then when your wife reached out and said, oh, you should interview my husband, I was like, of course I want to.
Yeah, that was
well, I'm here. I'm happy to, happy to help you out.
So just to get started, I'd like to hear a little bit about you, because it seems like just you as a person, because it seems like you have a heavy interest in ghosts. In general, because you've done these ghost, written these ghost stories. You wrote The Awakening, which is, we love. We did an episode on it already, and we both love it. And seems like you have another one in the works, a cartoon.
Oh, that really, that was just a passing piece of work that I did. It's really someone else's project that I helped out on. So, but yeah, I do. I mean, that's a kind of, Hotel Transylvania type cartoon, so it's really not the same kind of territory that I normally kind of go into. I'm always drawn to ghost stories. I don't really, you know, it's not the only thing that I write about, but I keep being drawn back to it because it's a really fruitful kind of landscape for me in terms of the emotions that are in ghost stories. I think it's, you know, I don't believe in ghosts. That's the kind of crucial thing that we should start from. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of writers that write about ghosts don't necessarily believe in them objectively. I mean, we could get into what we think ghost experiences might be, which is always an interesting thing. But just in terms of literature, I've always been kind of excited by the literature around ghost stories from the Victorian era, you know, the golden age of ghost stories and that kind of thing, you know, Arthur Conan Doyle and M.R. James and all the many, many people that wrote, you know, Dickens. I've kind of grew up on those to a certain extent and also grew up on the TV versions of a lot of them. So not only was I really getting the thrill of reading them on the page, but I really felt absorbed in the versions that they did on TV, usually on the BBC or sometimes independent television over here would do, you know, in the late 60s and the 70s especially, they would do a lot of period adaptations of famous ghost stories, much more, less so now. But like I say, when I was growing up, there would be a lot of anthology series. And I know there were a lot of horror anthologies in the States in the 60s, you know, Forrest Gump thriller and obviously Twilight Zone and Outer Limits and that kind of thing, many, many others, Night Gallery. Similarly in the UK, you know, so that was the kind of breeding ground of my imagination in a way. And I think people are drawn to scary stuff because they are a scared personality. I think this is it. And by immersing ourselves in the literature, I think we give ourselves a sense of security because we can always tell ourselves at the end, well, that was just a story and I survived it. Even if it's a downbeat ending in the story, at least I survived it, you know?
That's 100% how I feel about that. And that's why I love horror totally. So much. It's like...
People that don't understand horror, I always have to kind of make this defense of it, really. People that don't understand horror and not drawn to it think it's a completely inexplicable genre. Why would you want to write something or see something or read something that makes you feel bad or scares you or horrifies you or is unpleasant? And they'll never really understand that the impulse isn't always to gross out. It's not a kind of sadistic imperative. It's more a kind of neurotic one. I think horror writers are more neurotic than they are sadistic. You know, it's kind of like you know, it sums up when they asked Alfred Hitchcock, what are you scared of, Mr. Hitchcock? He said, everything. And I think right. I think that kind of sums up a lot of writers that I know and probably me as well, really. So I think that you find the genre that appeals to you as your personality, and that's why I keep returning to this realm of kind of ghost stories, because they, I mean, not you know, Ghostwatch was very much a one-off in terms of what it tried to achieve, but I keep going back to it in terms of drama, because the supernatural is a kind of magnifying lens to human emotions and dilemmas. I mean, you can have a, you know, like a soap opera can have all sorts of stories about grief and you know, death and all sorts of extreme things, but it can only go so far in terms of imagination. Once you add the supernatural or the paranormal, then you have a whole kind of poetic, you know, it's almost like magical realism. You have a whole poetic way of exploring those things in a way that's, you know, kind of imaginative and can be more revealing than something that's purely realistic and grounded in reality, you know. So that's kind of what appeals to me, really. You can kind of take off from just talking about the subject into something that, you know, that can be more, I was resisting the word profound, but I mean, I meant affecting, yeah. Can be more affecting the audience than if you do it through a genre.
I think you definitely hit the nail right on the head. I mean, even especially with what you said about people who really enjoy horror, I always felt like, you know, it's those of us with anxiety and worry that we live with every day that love horror, because it lets us focus it on one thing and then have it be resolved in our faces. You know, like
I think it's also why the fan, you know, the groundswell of fan interactivity is so strong. It's because we want to feel, as we do with all kind of literature and movies and everything, we want to feel that we're not the only ones feeling like that. And I think if you get together with other horror fans, you know, it's remarkable how you bond with them, because you share this common ground and you share certain similarities of outlook, you know, and that can be a great thing, I think.
Yeah, we definitely have we have bonded with our listeners in ways that I don't know that other podcasts can that aren't about horror, because we all share this very similar feeling with it about it. And, you know, there's no real arguments, like you like this movie and I don't, and that's okay. You know, we don't really argue with our listeners very much about our opinions. Even if they don't agree with us, they'll say, oh, well, I don't agree with you, but I appreciate what you said. Like, it's very respectful. Yeah, yeah. You wouldn't think that. And even on Twitter, like, we're lucky enough to really not have very many negative run-ins.
Negative, yeah, for sure. very interesting.
A very uplifting group of horror fans.
Yes, yeah. Well, actually, you know, I think a lot of the writers that I know, and I think I probably, you know, count myself amongst them, you know, it's hard to argue, but I find horror is an uplifting medium, even though it can be downbeat and can be dark and can be bleak. I think it's uplifting because like I say, partly you walk away from it at the end unscathed, apart from maybe mentally you might be scathed. But I think if it reflects how you feel about the world. And I think, in a way, the tapestry of horror is a kind of whole world of anxiety. It is really, you know, you know, 600 different shades of anxiety made real in different forms. You know, then people will relate to it, and in a way, they are made more secure by it. So, therefore, I think it is, in a way, a positive force. I would think very strongly. But of course, people that don't gravitate towards it or understand it don't understand what a positive force it is. When I think of, you know, the imaginative films that stay with me from my childhood, like the Hammer films, I guess I grew up on, and that kind of thing, the whole realm of those you know, fights of between good and evil and everything, they were probably as potent to me growing up as a religious upbringing in a weird kind of way. And the stories I read too, you know what I mean? They really kind of informed how I felt about things. And I think, you know, I really would argue for it being positive, really, because it is that oftentimes it's the imagination unleashed, and oftentimes it's about interior feelings. I think John Carpenter said something to this effect: horror is about interior feelings being let loose in the outside world, you know? And I think, however many different sorts of horror films there are, or stories going back to the Gothic, you know, in the 19th century, I think that still applies. You know, it's kind of like the unconscious goes crazy or is unleashed, you know, whether you're talking about, you know, the first Gothic novels or, you know, which I think what's fascinating about them is how they prefigured Sigmund Freud in a way by telling stories about unconscious desires and that kind of thing in poetic form long before he said there was anything kind of going on under the surface in human personality, you know? So it's kind of like, I think there's a wonderful novelist called Patrick McGrath. You know him, the Gothic novelist? He lives in New York now, but he's British born. And he wrote a wonderful book of stories called Blood and Water. But he, I've just read a book of essays and short stories by him, and he's very, very keen on the idea that, you know, you can trace a line from the Gothic novels through Sigmund Freud into modern horror about a literature based on the unconscious. And I think it's a very compelling argument.
Wow, I really need to read that. That sounds
amazing. Yeah, that's super interesting.
just to dive a little bit into Ghostwatch, when I was rewatching this, I noticed a lot of parallels between this story and the Enfield Poltergeist, and I was wondering if that was a heavy influence upon writing this story.
It wasn't a massive influence, to the extent that when people say, was it based on it? It really wasn't based on it. I did a lot of reading of poltergeist cases, both in the UK and in America. And I kind of formulated an archetypal case, in a sense, you know, a kind of dysfunctional family with, you know, two sisters around the age that they were, that kind of thing. And the family had broken up, so that there's an internal psychodrama going on in that family, clearly. And that was kind of an amalgam of lots of different things. I think what makes it resemble the Enfield Poltergeist is that for production reasons, it became inevitable that we set it in a suburb of London. Maybe it wouldn't have resembled it if we set it up north in Manchester, say, or Liverpool. And the other thing was, I actually deliberately brought in as a consultant Guy Playfair, who was one of the investigators of Enfield, simply because he was someone that had seen these kind of things firsthand, and I thought I knew him because I'd consulted him on a different project I was doing, and he was friendly and amenable, and I thought it would be great for the actors and director to talk to him about, you know, what it's like being in a house with these kind of things going on. I just thought it would be a useful thing. So he did come in and talk to them. I don't think he read the script. So he saw it when it went out, supposedly live, he was seeing it for the first time. But I think there were some unfortunate resemblances, not unfortunate to me, but in terms of the comparison, when they used the kind of voice on tape.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They made that very much like the sound of the voice in the Enfield Poltergeist. And the other thing is that they made, perhaps inevitably, they made the girl's bedroom quite like the, you know, the stills of the girl's bedroom are quite like those stills of the girls, you know, levitating in the Enfield case.
Yeah, the photographs.
So there are a couple of extra things that were done in production, kind of, you know, make it resemble it more than, in a way, more than I was intending. But like I say, what I was intending was a general kind of a general plausible poltergeist case.
I don't know if you get, you probably, it sounds like you get this a lot. And my intention wasn't like it's just like the Enfield Poltergeist. It was just something I noticed, and I considered it more of an homage than anything else. I the spoons being bent, the young girl hitting the pipes. And things like that.
Maybe there were things that I did. I definitely wanted a moment where there appeared to be a hoax, not hoax, the fakery seemed to be exposed. I thought that would be a good turning point, you know?
Totally.
But what did you guys think of, I'm turning it back on you now, the Conjuring 2, which I haven't seen, which was supposedly based on Enfield. Have you guys seen it?
We have. We actually did an episode on both Conjuring movies not that long ago. We both agree that there are good parts to it, but it doesn't necessarily feel very real towards the end.
Yeah.
It falls off.
Was the thing that I felt on the strength of the trailer, to be honest with you. It seemed so kind of preposterous, really, in terms of a house in London. No house in London looked anything like that. And American houses have bedrooms like 10 times the size of houses you'd have in a terraced house in London, put it like that. So it kind of it looked kind of crazy from my eyes, you know. Yeah. But I don't really buy that couple that do the investigating in those movies.
Yeah.
I don't know. Something implausible about them.
Ed and Lorraine Warren.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. They don't strike me as, I'm not going to say anything.
That's okay. We've said it already, so it's fine if you do.
Yeah. I will say they did a great job matching the pictures and wardrobe and things like that, too.
There was a very good three-part TV drama over here called The Enfield Haunting. Did you guys see that?
I haven't.
Ooh. It was produced by Sky, a TV company over here. I really recommend you see that. It was I suspect, much nearer the facts and actually really caught the period, and the look of the whole thing was very well done.
The one thing I wanted to just bring back, I'm sorry, I keep nagging on it,
yeah, but
the thing I do love about you having those allusions to the Enfield Poltergeist is that it makes it feel more genuine, in that if I'm a viewer at home and I don't know much about ghosts, but I remember the Enfield Poltergeist, then, and these things are happening again, I might feel more inclined to believe it's real.
Well, definitely I was aiming for that, which was, I didn't want in any respect to go down the route of a kind of movie version of it, which The Conjuring 2 obviously was. And that's exactly what I had to avoid in order to pull off what we had, which was a drama with a certain intent, you know, that had to be done in a certain way. And I couldn't cast it with actors. I couldn't add music. I couldn't create the scenes, suspense scenes, using cutting or, that kind of thing. So all the things you'd normally put in a screenplay, I had to not do, which was a great discipline, really. And I think sometimes a discipline can make you more inventive.
Sure.
I was saying on the other day to someone else that normally in a screenplay, the one thing you avoid is direct exposition of someone saying, this happened to me when I was a kid, this happened to me 6 months ago, blah, 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 and they tell you a story. You never do that, really, or you try and avoid it. And of course, if you're trying to duplicate outside broadcast or live TV, that's exactly what they do. They thrust a microphone in someone's face and they say, tell me your story, you know, and you say, well, this really happened to me, you know, and that was the crucial thing, really, a microphone in someone's face and someone saying, tell me what really happened to you, you know, and I think that's a really engaging. That's what TV is all about, in a sense. Not drama, but TV in general. So I wanted to make the most of something that seemed plausible. So hence, I researched all those cases, and I wanted to, even if people hadn't obviously done the research that I had, but I think that's the only way you try and get some believability about it, really, mm-hmm. is that, you know, people obviously know about bent spoons and that kind of thing, and watches stopping, you know, those little things that they pick up from these real cases, even if they're not necessarily true, but they pick up the mythology of them, you know? So that was my ammunition, in a way.
Yeah, I think it was a really smart choice. Personally, I think that's what really brought it in, and really I would imagine, I mean, I have to put myself in the shoes of someone in 1992 in the UK, which is, you know, as an American, it's a little difficult to do, but I would have totally fell for it. I told Carly earlier when we were recording, I was like, there's no way I totally would have fell for this, because I was, what, like 8 at the time? And
100% I would have as well.
Yeah.
No, I got
I'd have been right on board.
Yeah, I got a I got a little bit attacked by people that had kids around that age, but
only a little bit attacked. I heard it was a little more than a little bit.
Oh yeah, no, but I was specifically thinking about children that age. Oh. I went down the I was going to say off license. Do you know what an off license is? I guess you'd say supermarket, you know, to buy some drinks. off license is an old term here, which means that you can buy drink and you don't have to go to a public house. But anyway, I went down the road to a shop and the woman said, I need to have a word with you. My son watched that thing last night and he couldn't get to sleep because the luminous skeleton on the back of his bedroom door kept him awake. And I said, like, so why has he got a luminous skeleton on the back of his door? You know, that's not a good idea.
And what exactly did she want you to do about it?
Yeah.
But there were a few things like that. I mean, it was like the few days after, it was quite curious, is that I'd get something like that. And then like 5 minutes later, I'd bump into, I don't know, a builder that was working for me or something. And he'd say, oh, yeah, I watched that on Saturday. I didn't believe a word of it from the beginning to the end. So you go, all right, one person, you know, believed all of it. Another person believed none of it. And, you know, there are a whole pile of people in between somewhere, you know. But obviously you get all sorts of ranges of reaction.
Well, is there anything you wanted to ask Carly? Anything prepared?
Yes. Did you, when you were making this, did you expect it to receive the reaction that it received? Did you have any idea?
I think when I pitched it to the producer, I can't even remember if we mentioned it to each other. I think we probably did, but I think there was the potential of, you know, Orson Welles' War of the Worlds radio broadcast kind of hanging in the air. Although, you know, it's one thing to tell people they're being invaded and another thing to say people there's a ghost that's real. So I didn't think people would take to the streets, you know. I didn't think it would be mass panic, but I did think there was a chance that people might just be, you know, if we did it well enough, some people would think it really was happening. And I thought, well, we are going to try and do it as well as possible. So there is that possibility. It's not like we're going to try and not do it well enough for people to believe that, you know. So
right.
that was always kind of built in. But to be honest with you, I always say I kind of, you know, you can't, you know, we've got 11 million viewers or something, and you can't imagine every single individual person that watches it when you're writing it. You know, oftentimes you write for yourself, I think. And I wrote, I guess, for the person that I told you about, who was me when I was younger in my early teens, who loved ghost stories on TV, who would have been really kind of a little bit confused and then really excited by something as outrageous as this. And I thought, that's the person I'm speaking to, really. Someone about 12 or 14 who's watching something on a Saturday night and usually talks to his mates when he goes in to school on the Monday morning, and you know, school's pretty boring, so you always talk about what's on TV that weekend or the movies that you've seen. Mm-hmm. And just doing something that actually, you know, gets them excited about something different, really. So my thought was, maybe people will not, you know, people will not know what's going on for maybe 10 or 15 minutes, and then the penny will drop.
Mm-hmm.
As we say, and they'll think, I get it, this is a fake drama, and oh, okay, I'll watch it on that basis to see if it goes anywhere, kind of thing, really. So that's pretty much what I thought of. And, you know, the main point was that it was a drama. You know, BBC doesn't commission a 90-minute production on the basis of it being kind of spoof or a hoax.
Right.
It's going to make people just kind of giggle up their sleeve. They, you know, it was supposed to be about something, like all drama is, and I think when I first talked to the producer about it, I think we didn't really go into any depth about it, but she immediately saw that we could do a ghost story that would be really effective and also get a chance to have some fun at the expense of the television media at the time, you know, while we were creating hopefully something that's scary at the same time, you know. So that's the task that we set ourselves, really.
So we, just so you're aware, we asked some of our UK listeners to send us their recollections of the first time they saw Ghostwatch live, or the only time they saw Ghostwatch live, I suppose. It was very interesting to hear. And one of them stated that right before Ghostwatch, there was a magic show with a very loud noise ending, kind of a drop dead ending with told you to get really close to your screen and then turn your volume all the way up. And then it was just very loud noise in their face.
I don't remember that at all. There was as far as I know, what was immediately before Ghostwatch was a kind of a medical soap called Casualty, which had been running for many years. Before that, I think there was immediately before that, there was a light entertainment kind of game show called Noel's House Party, I think. So I'm not sure whether they watched what scared them on a different channel first and flipped over, whether there was another I think Halloween stunt done by a magician called Paul Daniel,
yes,
that they might be mixing it up with, and he did had one of these Iron Maiden torture instruments.
Yes.
Oh, gosh.
And he went inside it and the door closed on it, and it was the end of the show, and they gave the impression that it had all gone wrong.
And I actually watched that on YouTube recently.
Yeah, that's the only thing that springs to mind. But that wasn't immediately before. But maybe in their imagination, it's all become one thing.
Sure. Right. Yeah. Probably. Right. That's what happens, right?
Yeah. I love the fact that Ghostwatch, which was fake, has now got a kind of weird folklore attached to it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, people. You know, how many times do you see the ghost and all this kind of? All these kind of questions and misinformation has grown up. People say it was banned by the BBC. You know, was it actually banned? Was there any paperwork about it being banned? No. Was there a report into it? Not really. You know, so it's evolved its own mythology, you know, and my favorite bit of that is the director, Leslie Manning, who's a woman, read on Twitter once a conversation with people, and somebody said, "We haven't heard anything since about the director," and somebody else replied, "He's dead." So not only was she alive reading this, but she's also a woman. Yeah. You know, so that's the extent to which people can get things wrong now.
Well, especially when you're young and you see these things, and it's not like you can just. Until I think fairly recently, you couldn't just watch it anytime you wanted. When did the DVD come out?
But although people did record things on VHS, though, we did have, you know, it wasn't completely kind of the Stone Age. It was, you know, but it wasn't quite as easy as kind of pressing a button and recording something to watch later like we do now, almost everything. But, you know, actually, I haven't heard stories from anyone that actually recorded it and played it back and looked at it or, you know, I haven't heard anyone saying that. It was much more a case of, probably at the time, people didn't think it would be a program that was probably worth recording. That's the truth of it. Because they probably recorded, you know, high-end dramas or films or that kind of thing, you know, so they probably wouldn't have bothered. But, I think what's curious is that there are lots of stories of people saying they missed the ending or they missed the beginning or they didn't know what was going on or, you know, which is, you know, everyone's story about what happened to them is so different. You know, a couple of weeks ago I decided, because it's coming up to the 25th anniversary, I just asked on Facebook for people to share with me their memories of the first time they saw it, you know, and there was an awful lot of feedback of stories about, you know, and it's great to piece it all together, you know, the reactions of people in the room when this was going on, and you know, maybe a kid was getting freaked out by it and the parents were saying, no, it's not real, or the other way around, the parents are getting freaked out and the kids saying, don't be stupid, you know what I mean? But it's remarkable. I mean, quite remarkable that we're even talking about it 25 years later. It doesn't happen to many individual TV shows, you know, single drama. Yeah.
Congratulations, really.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Achievement. Yeah.
I mean, I wonder if this would, I wonder how, like, because obviously this inspired many films that came after it. I mean, whether anyone wants to admit it or not, I mean, I don't even think Paranormal Activity would exist without this film.
Well, Oren Peli, I was quite felt vindicated in a way, because he was interviewed on a magazine here, a London magazine called Time Out, which asked him, would you recommend any little known horror films, you know? Mm-hmm. And yeah, he mentioned, I think he mentioned three, one of which was Ghostwatch. Oh, so, you know, that, you know, being an American director, I thought, how the hell did you find out about that? But he didn't know about it. So that I thought was quite interesting. However, I don't think, you know, I don't slap myself on the back as being the person that invented kind of found footage movies, because I think found footage came about because of camcorders and the idea of people for very little outlay could buy a camera and wave it around and catch something very believable, and actually, you know, and edit it together. And if they were clever, they could make it into something that was quite scary, you know, and they didn't need high-end A-list actors in it.
Right.
You know, that led to a lot of development in the horror genre, in the sense that, you know, Hollywood as a whole realized, hang on, we can have a profitable film that doesn't have to cost a lot, doesn't have to have stars in it. You know, shitloads of people turn up to see it, and it'll make money. And then subsequently, you know, as I'm sure you're well aware, there's the kind of Blumhouse formula, as we talked about, the, mm-hmm. you know, The Conjuring and things like that. So it's become a kind of, but I think it was the general technology of accessibility to cameras that generated the found footage subgenre.
Well, and sure, but credit where credit is due. There wouldn't, like, Paranormal Activity has the video camera watching the people sleeping and ghost things are happening. I mean, that was yeah, your idea, yeah. Right? And that's what all, and
okay,
that's literally,
I'll take that, then.
And
I'll
that's literally
that.
All Paranormal Activity is.
Yeah.
So, I think the second or third one was a lot more like it with the kids.
Yeah.
Right.
To resemble it a fair bit more. So, so maybe it did have a lot more influence, really, which is nice.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, as a writer, like that should be a goal, right? That people like your work so much that they can play off of it.
Well, you know, that is the best thing about, you know, when it went out, you know, the tabloid newspapers had a kind of frenzy and went a bit nuts and people complained and all the rest of it, you know, all that kind of aftermath kind of thing. So the BBC got very, they got, I say, very freaked out, and they battened down the hatches and kind of like agreed amongst themselves, no one would see this again, we wouldn't mention it, and we pretend it hasn't happened. And that went on for about 10 years until the British Film Institute brought out Ghostwatch, or asked the BBC for permission to release it on DVD for the 10th anniversary, which was 2002. And then, you know, there'd been a big difference. And the internet was then really growing and a reality, you know? So kids, really, again, I'm coming back to kids around the age of 12 that seemed to be the big fans as they grew up, you know, started having forums, starting websites and discussing it and watching it again and organizing screenings and all the rest of it. So gradually we realized that all these people were out there that didn't actually hate it. In fact, they really loved it and wanted to talk about it, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and the most flattering and positive thing to come through the whole process for me is when people come up at a screening and, first of all, that they still enjoy it, even though, you know, it can't possibly be going live on a TV screen when it's projected in a big cinema. But they come up and say, oh, you know, it really freaked me out and I couldn't sleep 3 weeks and had to sleep with the light on. But I never know whether to say, I'm sorry about that or thank you very much. So I usually say both things. And then they say, but it made me really interested in horror. And it made me want to make horror films of my own, and that's a good feeling. That I guess I'm creating the anxiety-ridden filmmakers of the future.
just to
bring the whole argument round in the circle.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
And well deserved. definitely. and you also have people like us who are newly discovering this and know the mythos behind it and can enjoy it from that perspective, from the knowledge of what it was. And I told my as we told our listeners, learn about it first, then watch it, because it adds just such a whole nother level to it, because it's kind of hard to enjoy it as you could have in 1992. It looks like something from 1992, which is wonderful. But, you know, if you're used to watching very scary movies, it doesn't have the same effect. But knowing the history of it really makes it just such an enjoyable experience, I think. So,
and have you sat down and watched it with people that don't know anything about it and seen whether they have a reaction to it and stuff, or
I have not personally.
I haven't tried that. I've only watched it with my husband, who sat down halfway through and was like, "What are you watching?" And I explained to him, and he was like, "Oh," and he just was so interested and couldn't take his eyes away. He was just
same. I've told a lot of people about it, and they're like, "Oh my god, that sounds awesome! I'll have to check that out."
Well, we won't take up any of more of your time today, Stephen, but thank you so much for joining us. And
yeah, thank you so
it's
much.
A pleasure. It's been really nice to talk to you, and some different perspectives have come out, which I've enjoyed talking about. That's great.
Well, and
wonderful.
I'm happy to hear that. And congratulations on your 25th anniversary. I heard you're doing a Q&A in London. One of our listeners will be there. So,
fantastic.
Enjoy that. I hope you have a great day.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Great to hear from you.
Thank you, Stephen.
Okay,
thank you,
Stephen. Too.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
And if you're interested in contacting or speaking to or following Stephen Volk, he is now on Twitter, as he stated, at Steve Volk Writer, StevVeVolkWriter. And then his website is StephenVolk.net. So thus concludes our interview with Stephen Volk. I'd like to just take a moment to thank some of our British listeners. We have a couple stories here we'd like to read aloud, and I wish I had them reading these, because I feel like I hope we can do these stories justice, because they're just so much fun. But here's some personal accounts from some of our listeners. The first one is from Annette.
Okay, so this is Annette's account of watching Ghost Watch Live. I was 13 the night it aired. My older sister and I had been talking about watching it for weeks. My mom didn't want me to watch it. She thought I would find it too scary. My parents were going out, so we had the place to ourselves. We had the lights turned out and candles lit to make it extra spooky. Now we went into this knowing it wasn't real, just a bit of fun, but as the night went on, we got more and more suckered in. For instance, the presenters were real-life TV hosts. Sarah Green was the co-host of Going Live, a children's Saturday morning staple, and Parky, Michael Parkinson, was a national treasure. Surely he wouldn't lie to us. The viewer's phone-in number was the Going Live telephone number. They wouldn't give us out a real phone number if it was completely fake, right? They had us completely snowed. Then, of course, there was the quick glimpse of Mr. Pipes reflected on windows and shadowy shapes appearing in one shot and gone the next, leaving you unsure if you had seen something or not. Of course, not long after this, the candles were blown out and all the lights were turned on. I was petrified, but we couldn't turn it over. We needed to keep going. My mom came home just as it was ending. Cats meowing, cameraman down, the lovely Sarah Green in trouble, I refused to move. She was so mad at my sister for letting me watch it and sent us straight to bed. Till this day, I have a dislike of cats and have to close the windows if I can hear them scrapping outside at night. And also, if there is a tape recording of a demonic sounding voice in a movie, I have to mute it or I start humming or talking out loud so I can't hear it. I know how silly it sounds now, and I have rewatched it since, and it doesn't bother me anymore, but these things have become habit, all thanks to the BBC's War of the World style hoax. It's good to know I'm not the only one, though.
I love that.
So
thank
good.
You so much so for good. For sharing that, Annette. Yeah, she brings up a great point. There's quite a few instances in the special where they'll be like, "Oh, let's take a look at this image," and you'll see Pipes. You know, you'll see the Pipes image, and then they'll go away, and then they'll come back, and it won't be there anymore. So it's like, wait, did I see that or did I not see that? Are my eyes playing tricks on me? That was done very well. They did a good job of having pipes appear and reappear in random places throughout the special, so you're like, wait a minute. And I know there's at least 8 instances of seeing pipes. I only counted like 3 or 4. But I know that there's like a bunch more that I haven't caught yet. So it's just a lot of fun to watch and just play find the pipes, you know? It's a good time, man. Okay. So I'm going to try and read our next one from Lee. Here we go. So it was Halloween night, 1992, and I was 13 years old and just starting to discover horror movies and Halloween, as it wasn't something particularly celebrated in the UK back then. I had missed all the hype about Ghostwatch in the newspapers and on the TV adverts, but my parents mentioned it to me that evening, surprised that such a gloomy, creepy kid as myself was going out and not staying in to watch it. It had been advertised as a live broadcast from a real-life active haunting, which had been taking place in London over the past few months. All those involved were the same TV celebrities who always covered live events on British BBC TV, so it all felt absolutely genuine. Although I didn't think for a moment that anything would happen, or that the BBC were about to capture live, irrefutable evidence of the supernatural, I was expecting some creepy stories and interesting experts. I know it looks a little goofy now, but that's how TV looked over here at the time, and especially at such a young age. I bought into it 100%, so much so that on the night, I didn't even make it to the end. I reached the point at which the eldest daughter started speaking in a demonic voice, and I remember leaping from my bed to turn off the TV, thinking, nope, fuck this, I'm out. Maybe opting to watch it alone in my bedroom in the dark wasn't the smartest of ideas. Having seen it so many times now, I realize that if I had kept watching, the whole thing would have gotten so over the top that it would have been obvious, even to my young mind, that it was all a setup. But I didn't, and as it was never broadcast again due to the controversy it caused, it was several years before I got to see it again in its entirety. But the show was the talk of the playground for the weeks that followed. It grabbed all of the newspaper headlines for a few days, and there was even a live debate on the BBC where the writer was brought out to be berated by the angry viewers and asked to explain himself. Poor Stephen Volk. In truth, it was an amazing piece of TV, and any station would kill for a reaction like that now. It was a night that went down in British television law, and nobody who saw it, even in part, will ever forget. I just love that account. Thank you, Lee, for sharing.
Thank you, Lee and Annette. That's what I imagine. Yeah. Like, it makes, like, you know, it's so fun.
I hate that they brought poor Stephen Volk out to be berated by angry viewers. Oh, man. All right. Well, this has been such a fun episode. Thank you for joining us. It'll be business as usual next week.
Week?
Next month. Next month also, which starts with next week. So technically, I'm still right, Carly.
You are. You're yeah. So right.
Is there anything you want to shout out before we close the episode out?
I have had the most uneventful week I've had all month.
I've had the most eventful week, but I want to talk of none of it because none of it's good. So let's just skip it.
Well, not in like a good event way. Yeah. You know what I started doing this week? So Xbox just released backwards compatibility for my favorite video game of all time, Star Wars The Knights of the Old Republic. And so that's what I've been doing all week.
Well, there you go. That sounds lovely.
Yeah.
I haven't really...
You're welcome, listeners.
I haven't really been doing anything that exciting. I'm trying to think if I'm watching anything. I've just been binging Downton Abbey. I'm almost done with it. I'm on the last season. I binge that shit fast.
So good.
Okay. So let's close out. Thank you to Troy from Cave Bastard for our song Sequencing the Drone and Jason Link for our amazing logo. Visit finalgirlshorrorcast.com for information on them or to listen to any and all of our episodes. You can also find links for our shop and our Patreon page should you be looking for those things. We also have stickers if you're into free stuff and don't want to buy stuff from our shop or join us on Patreon. I'll still send you some free stickers. All we do is ask that you rate and review us on iTunes or retweet some of our episodes as a thank you. If you'd like some stickers, just send me an email, finalgirlshorrorcast@gmail.com, with your name and address, and I'll send some to you. Also, our Patreon members are currently very busy deliberating what the franchise is that we'll be discussing during the month of December. If you want special Patreon perks like that, visit patreon.com/finalgirlshorrorcast. It's a good time. I'm really excited to hear what they're choosing for us.
It is a super good time. If you haven't voted, please go ahead and
vote. We did have something planned out, but it's not streaming the way it was when we decided to do it. So we want to give the option to do other things that are streaming a little bit easier on different platforms. So we're doing that instead, and we're letting our Patreons pick. I think by the time that this airs, it will already be chosen. So you missed out on that. Sucks to be you.
Well, so then totally disregard my go vote, I guess.
Well, I mean, okay, let's think of it this way. We're closing voting on Tuesday. This airs on Monday. So if you're listening to this on Monday, you can still go on Patreon to vote. If you're not listening to this on Monday or Tuesday, go fuck yourselves, I guess.
Whoa, oh, I mean, shots fired.
No, thank you anyway for trying.
All right. My turn.
It is.
Final Girls Horrorcast is part of the Modern Horrors Podcast Network. This week's episode is sponsored by Elizabeth, Mikey H., Nick B., Jonathan W., Black Cat, Miss Tab, and the OT Gourmet Geek. Final Girls Horrorcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, TunedIn, and pretty much anywhere else that you can stream a podcast. We are also very active on social media, so please interact with us. You can find us on Twitter at FinalGirlsHC, and Instagram and Facebook, just search for Final Girls Horrorcast. We also invite you to join our Final Girls discussion group on Facebook. You can find the link on our Facebook homepage. As I say every week, we always have a super blast interacting with you guys on there. It's where I first saw the trailer for the one that we did today, and
you might impact our show.
Yeah, we talk about a lot of really fun stuff, and it distracts me from my job a lot.
I don't think you're supposed to say anybody that out loud.
I don't think anybody from work listens to my podcast.
Well, let's hope not.
If they do, JK, working hard all day. Shit.
So
all day, every day.
So as I said earlier, we will be back to normal starting next week. We have a really fun episode planned. We will be doing The Babysitter, which came out fairly recently. If you haven't seen it, it's on Netflix. Go check it out. We're also going to be discussing Hatchet, which is streaming on Hulu. I have still yet to see Hatchet. I'm really excited to watch it.
I haven't seen it either, because every time I go to watch it somewhere, it's only Hatchet 2 that's streaming.
Yeah.
And I don't want to start with Hatchet 2, so I'm really stoked.
That. Yeah, I was having that same problem, and now we have actual Hatchet to talk about, so I'm very excited to do that. So I guess we will see you then, guys. Until then, I'm Amy.
And I'm Carly.
Bye!
Bye!